Possible. And we are going to start with a special guest today, Stuart Alsop, partner at Alsop Lewy Partners. And I have known Stuart for ages. Welcome, Stuart. It's great to have you.
So that means I'm really old. Because you're still young. So if you've known me for ages, it means I'm pretty old. But that might mean I know something.
So you've literally been in the VC business for 20-plus years, and you've covered technology as a journalist for 20 years before that, and I've been in the business for 20 years.
Yeah. No, I've been working for 40 years. I graduated from college in 1975.
Right. So what is your analysis of the technology startup business today? How has it evolved? What do you see today? Where are we?
So when I started, this is 40 years, so you have to take that into account. But when I started, startups were not normal. The way the economy had developed in the 50s and 60s, and you know, when I started working in 75, you know, one of my first jobs, which I didn't go to until 79, was working at Inc. magazine, which was the magazine for startups. And then in the late 70s, you know, that was a weird thing. You had to have a magazine for it. And it was fascinating. That's what really got me started in the computer business, because that's when PCs started. But startups were, you know, something that most people didn't do. And so the big change, to be honest, is the fact that startups is a career now. But you hear students coming out of college and or even dropping out of college and starting companies as a career, that they're going to go do that for the rest of their lives. And that's possibly the weirdest thing for me, because I think it should be hard to start companies, and I don't think everybody should do it, and I don't think everybody should have venture capital. It's one of the reasons I love the Million to a Million is you celebrate businesses that don't raise venture capital and are still successful. That used to be normal.
Well, and that's the way it's going to have to be normal, because most businesses don't fit the venture capital framework. You know, they don't grow at, fantastic pace, exponential pace, and they don't go become, you know, $100 million businesses in 5 years. They just don't have the characteristics to do that.
So I try to get people to think about starting companies, not about raising venture capital. And, you know, maybe if they're lucky enough to get into a business that is in a high-growth area and really needs capital to grow, you know, and then we can talk. And even then, you know, we still don't fund 98% of the companies we talk to. So it needs to be a rare thing, not the norm.
So, Stuart, what trends are you most excited about in B2B technology right now?
Well, it covers a fair amount of ground. I mean, the context is that, and again, you know, to refer to my timeline, when we started with computers, PCs were, you know, these kind of radical things that people could own and didn't require white-coded people to take care of. And we've gone through a variety of these or a series of these transitions to the point now where technology is being infused into everything and beginning to transform what it's infused in. And so, I mean, I don't know if it's B2B, but autonomous driving is a big deal. It is kind of B2B because the technology needs to be embedded in the car, and, you know, the consumer gets the benefit of it. But the idea that cars will drive themselves, you know, not to mention, you know, what Elon Musk has done with Tesla in terms of the distribution system, selling direct to consumers and building his own distribution as a power distribution system and battery plants. So part of the transformation, part of it is that technology is being embedded in everything. So then there's particular kinds of technologies that are really interesting in that environment. And so one of the things we're really fascinated with right now and playing around with, and that we're not unusual in that, is sort of what's referred to as an umbrella term as artificial intelligence, of which there's a series of subcomponents, machine learning and neural networks and so on and so forth. And it's getting to the point now where, you know, back in the early 80s, there was a big artificial intelligence thing, and we kind of got ahead of ourselves and had those fantasies about computers being intelligent and but we didn't even have a network then. You know, we didn't even know that not having a network was a problem.
Right.
Now we have the network, and it's pretty fast, and, you know, it's pretty ubiquitous, and so we're beginning to kind of go back to the principles of artificial intelligence and integrate it into real applications and domains. And so that's just really interesting. I'll give you an example. We have an investment in a company called Hover. There are a couple of Hovers out there, so if you want to go look at this one, it's hover.to. And with Hover, just generically, you can go get the app and download it, and you can take 8 pictures of your house, and within a certain period of time, and that right now is a problem because demand outstrips our capability, within a certain amount of time, we will deliver back to you a precise 3D model of your house, which is like magic. And then the problem we're having right now is that we have too many people trying to get these models, and there's too much human labor involved. So we're in this deep process of using machine learning, neural networks, and underlying AI principles to teach our systems to recognize all the different elements of the house and build that 3D model without any human intervention. So
and what is the application of this technology?
Well, the current one, the visible one, which is pretty amazing because it produces a business model right away, is contractors will use their phone to take these 8 or more pictures of the house, and then on the spot, well, I shouldn't say on the spot because it's taking us too long to deliver these reports, they can use that information to then make a bid on re-siding the house or re-roofing the house or putting in new windows or, you know, all the stuff. They need those measurements in order to make accurate bids. And contractors are blown away by this because, you know, these are tool belt guys who previously have been looking at cell phones as, you know, a phone, but not much else. And now they're beginning to realize the phone they have is makes it easier for them to make accurate bids, to get customers excited about what they can do, and to deliver that work.
Cool. And in the domain of self-driving cars, are there things that you have identified as opportunities that, you know, startups can play in, and perhaps even, you know, venture scale opportunities within that realm?
Yes, well, okay, I'll tell you a story about our firm. So we were the lead investor at a company that got to be known as Twitch and was purchased by Amazon about a year and a half ago for, you know, $1 billion, the nice outcome. And we're very happy with that. Well, my attitude is any of the founders of that company, I should be following them around and with a checkbook and saying here. So I've written checks to 2 of the founders who then started new companies, one of whom has started a company called Cruise Automation. And Cruise Automation went down this path, being a venture-backed startup developing autonomous driving capabilities, originally as an add-on for existing cars, and then ultimately in a different model, which actually has never really been talked about. So I brought them in because I thought that what they were doing is pretty interesting, and so I brought them in, and my partner Gilman thought I was crazy for thinking that we should invest in this company, because he said that specifically, and so your question, let's see, Google's doing this, Apple's doing this, Uber's doing this, Tesla's doing this, Honda, Toyota, all these companies are doing this. Well, how could this startup company do anything that would be significant?
Yeah.
And Cruise is in the process of being acquired by General Motors for more than $1 billion.
So, all right.
Since I wrote a check into the company pretty early, made a little bit of money. And of course, my partner Gilman's been running around going, boy, what did I miss? And so there's always opportunity for startups, and no matter how many big companies. In fact, if there are big companies trampling around, that's actually more of an opportunity for precisely that reason, because Cruise was doing something that General Motors had tried to do, and General Motors knew they were falling behind. And so they felt they had to purchase this company for an extraordinary price. And that's, you know, half of the way people who invest in startups get liquidity.
There's also the security opportunity that would be probably a reasonable one for startups to follow. I mean, cars are going to become major hacking points. And, you know, you don't want your car to be hijacked by some hacker, whatever the hell it is.
that has not been solved yet, by the way, but we,
no.
But as a firm, we specialize in cybersecurity. As I think you know, my partner used to work with the CIA as the founding CEO of InQtel, which is the so-called the CIA's venture capital fund. And then we have a variety of other partners, one of whom is the former deputy director of the National Security Agency, who have deep domain experts in security technologies. And so about a third of our portfolio is security-related companies. And you know, I'm just a former journalist in D.C., so I've had to learn. Now I can kind of talk the game.
Yeah.
But the thing you're referring to, you know, is now generally bound as the IoT security opportunity, which is cars are a device, you know, your phone is a device, your toothbrush is a device, and then you have all these devices that are connected to the internet, which have no fundamental way of being protected.
And while your phone being a device and being hacked has huge consequences, depends on what you're happening. Maybe you're controlling your house, you know, home security and so forth through the phone. So that is a mission critical touch point, but the car is a dangerous touch point.
The car factory.
Yeah.
You know, if you get into this, the whole thing about Iranian nuclear processing plants, uranium processing plants was, you know, they got hacked because these were embedded devices that were developed before there was some network attachment, and someone, who knows, possibly us, figured out how to mess with those the chips in those devices. And so everything that previously was not connected to the network but is now being connected to the network is vulnerable. Phones are actually pretty well protected, and particularly, you know, Apple's
relatively,
got a pretty good reputation, but Apple protects its phones so much that the U.S. government gets pissed off at it. So it's really not the phone or the computer, you know, all of those, there's a huge investment in protecting those devices. The real opportunity now is to protect those devices which have not previously been connected but are now being connected to the internet. And the people that make those devices tend not to understand security, so the real issue is how do you deliver to them the thing that will make those devices secure without requiring them to become experts, but being the companies that make those devices.
So you take pride in investing in early and in disruptive tech. What are some other disruptive areas that you love?
There's a little bit of feedback going on, but we'll shoulder through. On my Twitter page, I say, send me the deals the other VCs think are too hard or too early. And that's thematic. That's how we do business, which is to say that we're old guys. My partner is younger than I am, but he's also been in the business for 40 years. And we've been around, and we know a lot about technology, and we have confidence in our ability to forecast what will happen. So our job as investors is to go find technologies that are not proven, not even finished, right? So we don't have customers, haven't finished the product, that are hard to do, that are hard to implement, and yet have tremendous potential as if built into a company. We lose most of our companies along the way, but this is traditional venture capital where you make it up in the one or two that are fabulously successful. And, you know, to be honest, we have a blast because we're looking at stuff that, you know, you don't even know about. Even you, Simona, don't even know about what we're looking at.
I'm sure. So the pace at which things are happening right now, it's harder and harder to keep up with all the things that are happening.
Precisely. And we get out there on the bleeding edge looking at stuff. So later today, the reason I'm going to the airport is I'm flying down to Los Angeles to check out humanoid robots. And the humanoid robots don't travel as easily as I do, so I have to go there to see them. These are robots that, you know, have facial features where, you know, you can see the subtle changes in their face, and they talk to you, and they have, you know, AI systems internally so they can be sensitive to your feelings. And it's a lady. But as soon as she turns her head, you see the big bubble of wires coming out the back of her head. This is obviously something that will be developed over time, but you know, we're going to go check it out and see what it looks like.
So talk to me a little bit about what do you see as the early stage investment game it's become very tricky, right, in the unicorn era. How does a small fund or even angel investors compete with the mega funds that put in $100 million in Series D with a 3X liquidation preference? How do you play this? How do you prevent getting washed out?
So it is a tricky business, and it requires really understanding your business and knowing how to run a venture fund. You have to be very careful you don't get ahead of yourself in terms of investing the amount of money that you have in the fund. And then you have to really understand. So we can look at a company and go, wow, that's like really cool. Like humanoid robots is probably in that category. And say, well, that business is going to take, you know, $50 to $100 million to really build out. And we won't really know until the later stages of that $50 to $100 million whether this team, whether the marketplace, whether the competitive situation really will turn it into a successful company. So we have to find companies that require relatively less capital, and you have to be very careful about that. You can't kind of fool yourself along the way and then get crushed later on. So you have to stick to things you can do. So we're not... The irony is, Hoy Partners started the same year as Andreessen Horowitz. We've gone and raised three funds, which total, I have to think about it now, but it's about $300 million. Current fund is $140. And Andreessen Horowitz has raised five funds for like $6 billion. Well, I don't know. They're better at raising money than we are, for sure. But, you know, they had a whole concept about how to build a first-class, top-tier firm, and it does involve you have to have a lot of money, you have to be able to write big checks, you have to be really bold about that, you have to provide all the services. Everything that Andreessen Horowitz did, they did intentionally to become one of the top 10. But we're swirling around in the back looking for the good stuff that other people don't know. We want to get there before Andreessen Horowitz. And by definition, Andreessen Horowitz or Sequoia or any of the big firms really can't play in the really hard stuff. So, you know, we're building a reputation over time of having carefully curated companies that have tremendous potential. And so when we need extra capital, we tend to be very influential in how those financings are done and very disciplined about it. And so, you know, we are able to, in our relationship with the entrepreneur and in the terms that we deploy, we are able to kind of get around and make sure we don't get stepped on by one of the elephants.
Do you talk to entrepreneurs about the philosophy of how they want to build companies? You know, there's clearly, my observation, there's clearly two different kinds of entrepreneurs playing in the market today, the ones who really believe in raising shitloads of money, and then there are entrepreneurs who want to do it for a reasonable amount of money and make sure that they actually have a better shot at making money. If you have a Facebook in your hand, it doesn't matter. But if you're operating in the, you know, higher probability realms of venture capital, which is still a very low probability game, you kind of have to do things in a more capital efficient way and get acquired for reasonable prices and so forth. And that's where the bulk of the entrepreneurs have to kind of navigate to so that they can actually create wealth for investors as well as themselves. Do you kind of sort for these two different mental models?
So you were making a false distinction there that being reasonable is a good way to be an entrepreneur. We are looking for unreasonable entrepreneurs that have a tremendously high expectation. We don't think you have to raise a lot of money to do that. So you were distinguishing between a lot of money and big outcomes and a little bit of money and reasonable outcomes. We're still very interested in unreasonable outcomes, and we think you can accomplish that without raising hundreds of millions of dollars. And a lot of us, I totally agree with you, Savannah. We have a similar point of view, which is raising money is not the point. So I have talked to entrepreneurs who are well covered in the press, who are raising money just because they can. You know, they can get $100 million for, 5% of the company or 2% of the company or whatever. I don't understand. I don't understand the investor's point of view, and I don't understand the entrepreneur. And you go, well, why do you raise more money? And I don't understand. And if you don't need it, why do you raise more money? And it's kind of like, well, it's because you can. Okay, well, that's great. Seems like you don't have a really strong idea what kind of company you want to have and what your principles are and how you operate the company. Kind of entrepreneurs I really get along with are the ones that have strong points of view and I had the privilege, not as an investor, but as an independent director, to work with John McFarlane at Sonos for 8 years. Mm-hmm. And I was on the board. And John doesn't raise any money he doesn't need to raise. And he's totally in control of his cap table, of the culture of his company, the point of view, what the objective of the company was, and takes it very personally. And so I had a blast working with John at Sonos, mm-hmm. and learned so much from him in terms of how he implemented his attitudes in the company. And that's a massively successful company, you know, that has, yeah. I don't know, I'm supposed to say, I think it's more than $1 billion in revenue, and has really transformed audio in the home. And so that's the kind of entrepreneur I like, the kind of entrepreneur that just goes out and raises money because they can and keeps doing it. You know, I don't know Stuart Butterfield. I mean, I know him. I've met him before, but why does he keep raising money for Slack? I'm not totally clear on that. He appeared to, what, he raised a couple $100 million recently for some huge valuation, but he's already profitable, I think. That's what I've heard. So I don't understand that at all, you know.
Well,
this is the thing. So I feel like I'm an old guy, and you know, part of my problem in the current environment is that maybe the principles that I grew up with are no longer valid, or maybe they are. It's a little hard to tell right now. Maybe I'm just a grumpy old fart that's sitting here complaining about the way these young kids are doing it these days.
Well, the point that I'm going to make to your point is that I don't think unreasonable entrepreneurs means stupid entrepreneurs. I think I'm a pretty unreasonable entrepreneur. What we are doing with 1 million by 1 million is a pretty unreasonable concept, but I'm not stupid, I can tell you that.
Yeah. I don't know if you've heard me talk about it before, but I apologize. I don't think you're managed by the FTC here or the whichever organization it is. But I have a thesis which I've been flogging for almost 30 years, which is the Silicon Valley asshole theory. And similarly, being an asshole doesn't mean you have to be a jerk. Being an asshole means you're driven to accomplish something. And a lot of the assholes out there created multi-billion-dollar organizations without raising money. It's not a one-to-one relationship. So the path to success is not something that's written in a book. And in particular, people who read books to find out what the path to success are the people who are probably not going to be the assholes of tomorrow. It's like, you know, you have to define your own success, and you have to find your own path, and you have to believe in something and see what the future looks like and then work towards that. And that can be a business that raises no capital and ends up being worth, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars, and there are no investors, so the entrepreneur owns the whole damn thing. Seen that many, many times, possibly more than the other model.
And being driven doesn't mean that you have to be an asshole either.
That's, well, being driven, that's kind of how I define being an asshole. So it's, I'm saying you don't have to be a jerk to be an asshole, but you do need to be an asshole to make a company successful. There are plenty of very nice entrepreneurs out there that build, you know, Michael Bell I use as a great example. He's a really nice guy, actually, and he's a real family guy, and he's, like, built a, you know, massively successful company without raising a lot of money until recently when he had to do that to buy EMC. But in the beginning.
So a slightly different question. Because you have so much perspective, including being in the media industry, what's going to happen to media? This is a complete implosion underway.
You haven't noticed? It's gone. The media business as we know it is gone. And you just need to accept that now I have old buddies that are still journalists, and they kind of go to me and go, well, can I become a venture capitalist? And I went, well, you know, what happened to me, you know, I think it was a long time then. It happened 20 years ago, back when there was still a journalism business and you could still make a living at it. And if you want to get out of the way of an onrushing train, you kind of want to do it before the train shows up and knocks you over. So I think the right attitude is to say what you believed about media that we may have learned in the period of time between World War II and the arrival of the personal computer is gone. That's done. But forget about it. Now, there are new businesses that are being born out of the ashes of that business, and those are very interesting businesses, and they do have a business model radically different than the ones that we're used to. And So over time, those new businesses that are born and will increase and demonstrate their power, because there's still the power of the word or the point of view or video. And there is this opportunity to create new businesses out of the ashes of the old one, but we shouldn't be sitting around thinking that, oh damn, the business I grew up with is gone. Shoof, it's gone.
It seems to me that brands kind of become media companies at this point, because the content is the brand in a world that is a viral internet kind of thing. But that's what's happening, right?
No, I don't agree with that. I don't believe that that's correct. Media companies are formed out of projects. This was true back in the heyday too. The big media companies, the ones that agglomerated around the 70s and 80s, were huge piles of projects, and that's why they're so badly managed, and they're, there's a lot of internal politics, and because everybody's fighting for their project and what they believe in. That's still fundamentally true, and brands operate out of a product management environment, which is very different, and the product is king, and you really have to pay attention to that. That's media products or projects is different than building consumer products. And so I know what you're talking about, because GoPro is supposed to become a media company, and Red Bull is really a media company and not just selling you drinkable like caffeine. That's great, as a brand, if you can get to that.
It's
place,
very hard, because if you're selling a toothbrush brand, how can you build a media company around the toothbrush brand? How much toothbrush-related content can you publish?
Well, the thing you have to focus on is if you're a great branded company, and Apple's an excellent example of this, but there are hundreds of them. If you're a great branded company, you know how to tell a story. You have a point of view. You care and you're passionate about the thing that you do. Well, those are elements that are true also in media, although the passionate commitment part is usually committed to something different than the product. But so these are principles of marketing when you're doing consumer or business consumer companies. If you have customers, the customers want to know where you stand and where you come from and what you believe in, even if you're buying toothbrushes. I don't really care about that, but maybe people who take better care of their teeth care about that. It's an important thing, and it's easy to conflate the two things, but they are separate. The media business is still servicing consumers for a different purpose.
So last question, what are you looking to invest in right now, going forward, that our entrepreneurs should be aware of?
We're so all over the map, it's very hard to say that there's one thing. We are fascinated by vehicular technologies, batteries, autonomous driving, artificial intelligence. We have a company that's doing embedded heads-up display. It's a material that you can embed in glass that allows you to project digital images in the glass. So we have semiconductor companies, we have materials companies, we have cybersecurity companies. So we're a little bit of like, show us everything you got, and then we'll pick out some stuff that's fun to play with, and we like to have fun. So, and fun partially is how much money you can make. So we're totally into making money. We are greedy venture capitalists, after all.
Well, venture capitalists, if you're going to manage people's funds, if people are going to pay you to manage their funds, you have to deliver on the money side. Otherwise, you're not in the game.
Yeah. Although,
all right, well, thank you, Stuart.
Yeah. Okay, thanks, Shimana. I was going to say, institutional investors are not the most fun people in the world, but they do get happy when you deliver a lot of money to them. So.
Thank you for coming, Sue. It was good catching up, and keep in touch.
Absolutely. Thanks a lot, Shimana. Have fun with your businesses here, and do a good job pitching, guys.
Bye. Take care.